580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 here on December 6, 2009. Today we're going to be talking about diversity in the media, the state of it, and what role the Federal Communications Commission and the federal government has to play to see that there is diversity in our media. Joining us is the ideal person, the Chief Diversity Officer from the Federal Communications Commission, Mark Lloyd. He'll be with us here for the entire hour. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the program. But before we go to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Comcast, the largest cable and residential broadband provider in the country, announced Thursday morning that they are going to purchase a controlling stake in NBC Universal, one of the largest media companies in the world. If approved by federal regulators, this merger would create a media behemoth that reaches hundreds of millions of homes and stretches across content production and distribution, movie and television studios, and broadcast television stations. The merger, which will be the first deal of its scope and size under the Obama administration, is strongly opposed by public interest and consumer groups like Consumer Federation of America, Media Access Project, and Free Press, unions like the Communication Workers of America, and smaller cable companies represented by the American Cable Association. Josh Stearns is program manager of Free Press. He says that this merger would put incredible power into the hands of one company. But this won't just impact diversity on the airwaves. The deal will also hit our wallets.
It's going to raise prices, it's going to limit competition, and it's going to open the door for a whole new wave of mega media mergers.
In an era where online video is on the rise, the merger could spell disaster for consumer choice in online video platforms like Hulu, Netflix, iTunes, and others.
We're likely to see Comcast begin to clamp down on NBC and Comcast content, which is going to really inhibit the growth of these online video projects. We could imagine a time when Comcast began limiting people's access to NBC content or to Comcast content online unless they were a Comcast subscriber. So picture this. If you want to watch 30 Rock, you better be a Comcast subscriber. That's how it could be if you want to get 30 Rock online.
Free Press is rallying public opposition to the deal. Stearns explains that stopping media consolidation was a key part of President Obama's media and technology campaign platform. His administration's response to the merger will be an important test.
We need a public outcry like we've never heard before to stop this deal in its tracks.
To find out more about the Comcast-NBC merger, visit freepress.net/Comcast.
Entertainment companies have slashed budgets to the bone, leaving fewer new scripted programs in the nightly lineup and a lot of writers and actors out of work. Many are migrating to the internet. The web is giving them a chance for success unavailable in the legacy network system. Actress Ruth Livier knew her ingenue days were coming to an end. She began acting at 15 and had a successful 3-year run on Showtime's Resurrection Boulevard. After 15 years in the business, she took script writing classes with the hope of writing a TV pilot. She came up with a bilingual show about a small-time Mexican-American talk show host named Ilse, spelled Y-L-S-E, but realized it would never make it onto a network. She retooled it for the web, got a small crew together, and began production.
I didn't want it sitting on my bookshelf. I've heard so many scripts end up just sitting on shelves. And this was an opportunity to go out there and produce it and distribute it on a worldwide basis. So I got subtitles in English and subtitles in Spanish, since the original version is bilingual. And that way, I think it just even broadens our potential audience base.
The first year, Ilse could be found on its own website, ilse.net, and on YouTube. Now in its second season, the show is hosted on a number of sites, including Blip TV and Cine Dulce. Livier says content creators are finding each other through these new web channels.
That's also one of the exciting things on the web, that people from across the country, people that are creating channels, have found Ilse and have asked me if they could host the show. And for us, it is a win-win because we get their audience to be a part of their lineup with the audience that they already have built in. And for them, it's the same. They bring Ilse audiences to their site.
Livier is hopeful that these new online video channels will soon be attracting advertisers. But right now, the name of the game is inexpensive production and distribution, which is all web-based. And for that, she needs an open, neutral, and fast internet. Being completely independent, she says there would have been no way that she could afford to do this otherwise.
Because the net is free, then I can distribute it worldwide, and then I get to compete for eyeballs and for hits just on the basis of the quality of the content. People are coming on board because they like the show, but I needed to get the show out there for people to be excited about it and want to be a part of it and support it.
For Livier, access is the key for content providers and for viewers.
Right now, the way the internet is, we have net neutrality. And if they change it, then the user's not going to have control of the internet. It's going to be the powers that be who are going to decide what we can or can't watch, should or shouldn't watch. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, December 6, 2009. First off, I want to apologize for what happened last week with the mix-up. Our guest that we had planned to bring in live, Steve Early, there was some confusion. Fortunately, we did have the recently recorded program with Peter Richardson available on Ramparts Magazine, which we were able to air in its entirety. We will have Steve Early back to discuss the book. He will be on the program at the end of December. In fact, I think the planned schedule at this point is 3 weeks from today, so we will get that Steve Early show on organized labor and the media on the air. I know a lot of people are looking forward to that, so do stay tuned. Today, we're very fortunate to have as our guest someone who's been on the program before and someone who probably doesn't need an introduction to people who follow these issues closely. Mark Lloyd is now at the Federal Communications Commission in the position of Associate General Counsel and Chief Diversity Officer. But before that, he's worn many hats as a communication attorney, as an activist, as a scholar, and as a professor, adjunct professor at MIT, teaching communication policy. Probably someone whose career leaves him as knowledgeable on the issues of communication policies only as all but a very small handful of people in the United States. So it's a great opportunity for us to have him here on the program. Mark Lloyd, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, too. We've had a lot of listeners have asked to have you as a guest over the last 2 or 3 months since you've assumed your job at the FCC and probably gotten a little more attention than you had earlier in your career. You know, I guess, Mark, the place I'd like to start is, you know, what is your job currently at the FCC? What does Associate General Counsel / Chief Diversity Officer entail?
Well, mainly, the General Counsel's office at the FCC is an office of lawyers. There are about 30 or so lawyers that represent the Federal Communications Commission. And we provide advice to the bureaus and the commissioners and the different offices in the commission at the direction of the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. And so mainly we work as lawyers representing the commission. And so we work on areas related to things like administrative law and different transactions that need to be approved, any litigation that goes on where people are upset with the FCC or suing some other party that's licensed by the FCC. And we provide, again, just a general range of advice as lawyers to the FCC. The FCC is mm-hmm. our client. As the Chief Diversity Officer, my portfolio in the General Counsel's office focuses on what it is that the Federal Communications is doing to promote diversity as part of our public interest mandate. And that ranges from everything related to equal employment opportunity rules and regulations to the business opportunities of those who want to own the media, to different contracting opportunities that might be available to and a lot of my work these days has been focused on things like broadband. And what we've put a panel together, day-long panel, focusing on diversity and civil rights issues in relationship to the National Broadband Plan. And a lot of that was about making sure that we were encouraging or setting up rules to encourage the deployment to all of America, rural America, urban America, to all different kinds of Americans, older Americans, Americans with disabilities, Native Americans, and also that we were looking at rules that might encourage the adoption of broadband services. And so there are lots and lots and lots of laws that affect policy, and obviously the other way around. And so that's my portfolio and keeps me pretty busy.
Well, yes, and Mark Lloyd, you were on our program before talking about the book you wrote, Prologue to a Farce, which is a history of communication and democracy in America, published by the University of Illinois Press. And also, I forgot to mention in the bio for you that before becoming a communication lawyer, you were a broadcast journalist and worked for NBC and for CNN. So you really have a wealth of experience. And, you know, I think the question I'd like to ask you is, you know, from all the work you've done as a civic activist on broadcasting issues, communications, as a scholar, as a communication attorney working the system, what have you learned about the FCC and government in the last 9 months or 6 months since joining the FCC that you didn't know, even though you've been working in the area for two or three decades before that?
Well, it is my first time working for the government, for the federal government. And it is a lot more complex than I imagined. And I had some sense that it was going to be pretty complex, but the number of lawyers just in the general counsel's office, I was surprised at the number of them and the fact that they keep pretty busy on a wide range of things. And today is such an unusual time. These are really just incredibly fluid times regarding media. And I suppose, as you know, they've long been very changing times. But the fact that we have a mandate from Congress to come up with a national plan to promote broadband, that we have opened up a proceeding to begin in earnest looking at what sort of rules need to be put in place for network management related to the Internet, that we're looking at trying to clear more spectrum space for both commercial uses as well as public safety uses, and that all of these things relate to each other and relate to the newspaper industry and the cable industry and the broadcast industry. And that there are tremendous economic forces. Obviously, media telecom is about a good sixth of our economy, that are having an impact on the broadcast industry and obviously the cable industry. And trying to figure out how all these things relate to each other is it's a very complex task. So I think if I've learned anything, it is that the work of breaking down the different silos at the FCC is going to be a major challenge. The Federal Communications Commission is divided not only into offices like the General Counsel's office, but we also have the Office of Communications and Business Opportunities. We have Consumer and Governmental Affairs Office. We've got the Media Bureau, which handles with broadcasting and cable. We've got the Wireline Competition Bureau, which handles wireless and wireline telephone operations. We've got the Wireless Bureau. But all of these things relate to communicating in America, and the work of the bureaus often overlap, the tensions between trying to maintain a thriving commercial industry here in the United States, and also trying to make sure that the public interest, whether it's public safety or democratic engagement or whatever, that those things still exist, is there are real tensions within the FCC. So it's far more complex. And that doesn't mean that anybody at the FCC ought to be let off the hook. But it's very complex in a very quickly changing world.
Our guest, Mark Lloyd, you've just been listening to the Associate General Counsel and Chief Diversity Officer at the Federal Communications Commission. Before that, for many years, a scholar and an author on communication policy and activist for a number of groups in Washington, D.C., and a broadcast attorney for both commercial and non-commercial stations for a law firm in Washington, D.C., as well as a practicing broadcast journalist for both NBC and PBS. You know, Mark Lloyd, I think probably in my career as a scholar and working on these issues, right through to the present day, the one hot-button issue of communication policy has always been and remains the Fairness Doctrine. People who don't know much about anything about the FCC or about communication policy, that's the one issue they know about. And it provokes strong reactions, either pro or con, either way. But not a lot of people know that much about it except the name. And either they think it's a really good thing if they like it or a really bad thing if they don't like it. But when quizzed, they don't know much else about it. What is the Fairness Doctrine? What is its status? And, you know, what is its importance?
Well, I have a fairly I understand to be controversial and unusual view of the Fairness Doctrine, which is not reflected in my book. That part of that was edited out because it was just getting too long. But I make the argument again. This is my argument. This is not I'm not speaking on behalf of the FCC. But I make the argument that the Fairness Doctrine really goes back to the early battles establishing the Federal Radio Commission. And as you've written very eloquently, when the federal government was petitioned by many private commercial broadcasters to clear up channel space so they could really have a thriving commercial broadcast industry, they made a distinction between those stations that were operating in the general interest of the local communities and those stations that they deemed to be propaganda stations. And they offered stations that were commercial and supposedly serving the larger local communities better airtime, longer service hours, more power than they offered to the so-called propaganda stations. Propaganda stations, and you can tell the story better than I can.
You know, like this one would be considered a propaganda station because it is an educational institution. It's
exactly.
Nonprofit, so it had dubious motives since it wasn't simply out trying to make money.
That's right. That's right. So the propaganda stations, the stations owned by unions and churches and educational institutions, were many of them, the vast majority of them, were forced off the air, and there was a preference given to commercial operations because they were thought to be not speaking with one voice about one particular issue, but they were open to all comers, supposedly. I made the argument that this is really the beginning of the Fairness Doctrine, that the notion that somehow local radio stations were supposed to serve the larger community, not just one voice or one interest, I think derives from this core idea. And that what was put in place was, again, the idea that all broadcasters have an obligation to operate on behalf of the local community and to present issues of interest and controversy in local communities and to do so in a way that was fair. The early Fairness Doctrine cases go back to the 1920s, before the establishment of the Federal Communications Commission. And I think one of the earliest cases that's cited in the famous Red Lion case from 1969 is a case called Great Lakes Broadcasting, which was decided by the Federal Radio Commission. And shortly after the establishment of the Federal Communications Commission, in the mid-1930s, the National Association of Broadcasters adopted the ideas that were later articulated as the Fairness Doctrine as part of their NAB Code of Conduct. So again, this is well before 1949. And what happened was that, you know, after a while and through administrative proceedings, a certain body of law developed interpreting this core idea that, one, all local broadcasting operations were required to cover issues of importance in the local communities, and, two, that they were supposed to do so in a way that was fair. And that is and became what we think of as the Fairness Doctrine, that two-pronged test. It was not until the late 1960s that the local community had any say over whether or not issues of interest and controversy in the local community were actually being served in a way that was fair.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the roughly the Fairness Doctrine was all the laws were sort of pulled together and rearticulated in roughly 1949. In a case, again, sort of sharpening the ideas around the Fairness Doctrine. But we had almost 40 years of law around the Fairness Doctrine before local communities, citizens, viewers, listeners, had any say over whether or not the broadcasters were operating in a way that was fair.
And that began, you said, in the late 60s, Mark?
Exactly. So mm-hmm. This was with the United Church of Christ v. FCC case. This is when the United Church of Christ under Everett Parker took the Federal Communications Commission to court and said, you know, the local citizens really should have standing if the local radio stations and television stations are supposed to be operating in the local public interest. It doesn't make sense for the local communities not to be able to talk about what the public was interested in if the stations were supposed to be operating on behalf of the local public. So that was the case, and that really sort of generated an awful lot of citizen activity around broadcasting. But again, it took, you know, from roughly the mid-1920s until the late 1960s for the Fairness Doctrine to really have much of an impact on what it was that the broadcasters were doing.
And, Mark, it's not entirely coincidental that the late 1960s and 1970s was also the period of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement and the student movement, a variety of social movements that took an increased interest in media policy. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And, you know, and the movement against the war in Vietnam. So, I mean, all of these movements sort of coincided, and again, you know, I've made the argument that particularly the civil rights movement and you know, Everett Parker working with the local chapter of the NAACP, they were the ones that brought this case, and they thought of it as civil rights law, of law related to, you know, the equal rights of all citizens, not just African Americans or Latinos or one particular group, but the equal right of all Americans under law in the United States. So.
And so then its heyday, so to speak, came from the late 60s. And how did it play out? How did it work? And how did it end?
Well, despite the fact that it did have some impact on Warren Berger's decision in establishing standing for citizens and local communities at the FCC. And local groups have organized and made arguments at different stations, radio stations and television stations, were not being fair. Of the vast majority, 90% of all fairness doctrine complaints were dismissed handily. It had almost no real impact on what local radio stations or television stations did in terms of their programming, and certainly did not shut down. I think the Fairness Doctrine may have resulted in the shutdown of one local radio station in its 70 plus year history. But that's about it.
And I guess, Mark, I'd interject here just for the sake of listeners who might not know a great deal of this history, that in a system of commercial broadcasting where commercial broadcasters get licenses to monopolistic rights to a very small number of channels that are in great demand, that unless the government's willing to take a license from one group and give it to another, it doesn't necessarily have very much leverage over an existing broadcaster if they know there's no real threat.
That's right. I mean, what was useful about the Fairness Doctrine, again, this is my view, this is not the view of the FCC, what was useful about the Fairness Doctrine really was one step in a series of steps that allowed local communities to have some impact on what it was that broadcasters did. And the other things had to do with the length of the license terms, with the number of stations that one owner could control, with, there was a whole regime in place that really suggested to local broadcasters that they really needed to try to provide service to local communities. But there were also other pressures, like non-commercial broadcasting when it got started. And so there were a wide variety of things that really had an impact on what it was that local broadcasters did. The Fairness Doctrine is, again, this is my view, in many ways sort of a simple answer to a very complex set of problems, and I tend not to actually believe in simple answers.
Let me interject, if I can, right now, Mark Lloyd. For listeners who just tuned in, you're listening to Mark Lloyd, the Associate General Counsel and Chief Diversity Officer at the Federal Communication Commission. He's our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We're talking about the full range of media policy issues. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Mark Lloyd, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the Fairness Doctrine and its history right now. Mark Lloyd is a communication scholar as well as an attorney before joining the FCC. And Mark, I think you were bringing us up to the present on it.
Yes, and so roughly during the Reagan administration, the NAB eliminated their code of conduct under pressure from the Justice Department and the Reagan administration. The courts determined that the FCC was within its responsibility to eliminate use of the Fairness Doctrine as a determinant of broadcast licenses during the Reagan administration. And so to a great extent, the use of the Fairness Doctrine, even though it was approved by Congress and actually and most broadcasters supported it, the Fairness Doctrine went by the wayside during the Reagan administration, along with a host of other rules.
Mark Lloyd, is it fair to say, as commonly said, that the growth of conservative talk radio, there's a preponderance of the announcers are on the political right and really strong partisans of one particular political party and one wing of that party, would not have been able to take place until after the Fairness Doctrine was formally scrapped. Is that accurate?
That's the usual line. I do not believe that's the case. I think it's much more complex than that. I think media consolidation has a great deal to do with it. One of the things that we argued in the report, a structural balance on media ownership, was that it really wasn't the Fairness Doctrine didn't cause the growth and power of conservative radio, and returning the Fairness Doctrine won't solve that problem. That one of the things we argued was that, in large part, the fact that you can have one operator like Clear Channel own 1,200 radio stations allows for the growth of one particular kind of format. This has an impact not only on political talk shows, but also on the sort of music that we hear on the radio as well. And so the argument that we said is that the reason that you get what you get is not necessarily because that's what it is that listeners want to hear. It's because that becomes the least expensive, most profitable sort of broadcasting for one owner to put out over many stations, over many hours during the broadcast day. Again, the argument that we made was that this is a structural problem related to ownership, related to media consolidation, related to the fact that operations like Premier that produces and distributes Rush Limbaugh also is related to Clear Channel. The folks that distribute Sean Hannity are related to some of the major broadcasters in this country. And so the argument that we were making was that these were structural issues. This is not just a matter of, what it is that listeners want to hear. It's what it is that the folks who own these stations want to put out.
Our guest today, Mark Lloyd, the Associate General Counsel and Chief Diversity Officer of the FCC. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Our phone lines are open. Let's go to our first caller right now. Line 1, Champaign County. You're on the air with Mark Lloyd.
Yeah. I always go back to the Moore speech argument, and I just wonder about the whole argument about some kind of content-neutral way of supporting what is a burgeoning possibility of alternative and voices and diversity in the media. But at the same time, I still think that is there any legal way of, getting around the government interference with the corporations, allow right to spew whatever they want to spew, and in some way of... I'm at a loss because, the litany of voices you just referred to, which I only occasionally monitor, are, just getting some kind of word in edgewise on those channels would, I don't know whether it would do much good since it seems to be a true believer kind of phenomenon, but just something that would, I don't know. I don't think there's really any way of doing it, but I guess I'm just laboring with the idea that it would be nice to just, instead of making the argument that there should be a way of subsidizing independent media movements and community stations and people that haven't even thought about being on any kind of media to get more voices out. It seems like it would be nice if there would be a way to do both of those things in some way that wouldn't... discomfort the government's role. I hope that's clear enough, and I guess we'll just hang up and listen to the airwaves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. And I think if I can paraphrase Mark, he's sort of getting at the issue you were getting at about structural concerns.
Well, I think the caller identifies some of the tensions, and we have a very strong commitment in this country to freedom of speech. And in my interest is not and has never been to shut down Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck or any of these other guys or to restore the fairness doctrine. And we really are interested in trying to find a way to create opportunities for all sorts of Americans, regardless of political ideology or, you know, identity politics or, you know, income or region or anything else. How do we make sure that all Americans have an opportunity to participate in the great conversation that should be America? And the interest is in trying to find a way to create more avenues for speech, not to shut down speech. And to some extent, it can be a thorny problem, trying to find a way to wrestle with not only new technologies, but also antitrust law, and trying to make sure that folks really have an opportunity to compete effectively in local markets is, you know, another part of the challenge. But I think that the caller sort of understands the core thrust. We do want to try to find a way to create more avenues and opportunities for speech, not to shut people down. And the focus is certainly not on the content, not on the ideology, but the fact is that you know, the way that things stand, or at least the hope is that with the internet, with new technologies like smart radio developing, with the opportunities that might be created with low power FM, we might actually be able to create more room and more opportunities for alternative speech to get on the air, and that's really what we're hoping we can get done here.
It's interesting you would say that, Mark Lloyd, because from my experience in the last few months, in the last few years, one of the rallying cries among some political conservatives, especially those who have talk radio and cable TV news programs, is that the Obama administration and the current FCC are obsessed outwardly and secretly and in combination with returning to an aggressive fairness doctrine that in their view would effectively force all political conservatives off the airwaves. Nothing you've said or no evidence I've seen suggests that's the case. But have you felt that too? It seems like there's a sense out there that the fairness doctrine is this grand plan to turn broadcast media in the United States into a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party.
Well, we have very rich discussions at the FCC. I must admit there are a number of folks who are just sort of perplexed about the fact that there are folks who think that we want to go back to the fairness doctrine. And again, my view is that the fairness doctrine, you know, was not especially effective at spurring democratic engagement and promoting civic discussion, that it was, you know, as part of a package of things, it was okay, but it was certainly not an easy answer. But I haven't heard anybody at the FCC suggest that, you know, the answer is the return of the fairness doctrine. I can't speak for everyone, but, you know, I can say that I think there is surprise and, you know, a little bit of, you know, confusion about the fact that folks seem to think that that's what it is we're up to when it's pretty far away from what we're working on.
You know, Mark Lloyd, you're the chief diversity officer, and one of the striking statistics of the last 10 or 12 years of broadcast and cable system ownership in the United States is that the number of minority owners, and I think women owners for that matter, of radio and television stations has declined and even precipitously as ownership has become increasingly concentrated. And I guess the question, no one denies that, the statistics are quite clear in that. The question, though, is in the era of the internet and broadband and websites and the blogosphere, is concerns with minority ownership of radio and television outlets sort of a horse and buggy issue, a 20th century issue, when, you know, the real action's moving online?
Well, I think there are a variety of views about this within the FCC. My view is this. my view is that print matters, that newspapers matter, that magazines matter, that books matter, that the telephone matters, wireline and wireless matters, even though it's, you know, old technology in many cases, that television and radio, even though they're not the latest technology, that they still matter in our conversation, that cable matters, that all of these so-called old media, from print, from billboards to pamphlets being handed out on the street, that all this stuff matters, and that the notion that somehow there is some media that's not going to become important in what scholars call our media ecology and our entire media environment, I think is wrongheaded. Sort of like the Fairness Doctrine, it wants to take a far more simpler view of a very complex environment than I think is useful. So local radio stations still matter in local communities. And again, my focus, wrongly or rightly, is on local speech and conversation. I must admit, to some extent, I'm not as concerned about, you know, making an awful lot of money in broadcasting, but what is the impact of broadcasting on our democracy? And I think radio still matters. I think low-power radio, which, you know, may not even cover an entire city, can be extraordinarily important to local communities. It may be, particularly in language, the only community or the only communication that certain communities can actually find out what's going on in their language, in their local community. So I think all of this media still matters. Even though there are great hopes for the Internet, and I think that the Internet may help to provide more avenues of conversation, radio will still have a place, television will still have a place, newspapers, magazines will still have a place, and I think we've got to figure out, you know, how we can get these things to thrive so that they can actually serve local democratic discussion, but I do think they'll have a place.
Well, Mark, if you look at, say, communities of color in the United States today, be it, say, Chicago, Illinois, Champaign, Illinois, Washington, D.C., and you look at the media serving these communities today, and throw in the old media, the radio, TV, newspapers, and the new media and the Internet, I mean, what's your assessment? I mean, are we in a new golden age? Is this have the technologies lifted us to a place we've never been before? Are things better than ever, or are we in a crisis? Are we somewhere in between? What is the state of our media for people of color in the United States today who live in communities of color?
Well, I think we're somewhere in between, and I think the challenge is, and you've heard me make this argument before, Bob, that it's that poor people, by and large, don't have media that serve their interests. It doesn't matter whether they're people of color. It doesn't matter whether they're recent immigrants. If you are a poor Russian immigrant just coming to America, it's very difficult to find media that actually serves your interest. A very good friend of mine, Dee Davis, who, you know, runs an operation in Whitesburg, Kentucky, you know, can tell you about the challenges that poor white Appalachians feel. Poor whites who are living, you know, not really all that far from Boston, are having some of the same challenges. And so, while there are incredible disparities, if you sort of look at racial groups, there's a significant disparity between those who have and those who do not have, without regard to what color they are, here in the United States. And I think we need to sort of begin to try to find a way to address all of these disparities, the disparities between those who have and those who do not have, between those who are so-called white and those who are so-called black. I mean, I think we need to find a way to address these disparities because they are a clue. They're an indicator to a problem. But it is complex. It's never quite as simple as it seems. And again, if I were to describe the main disparity, it's between those who have wealth and those who do not have wealth. And unfortunately, a great deal of those folks who are considered minorities in our society do not have wealth. And as a result of that, we don't see their faces. But in the same instance, when I grew up in Detroit, looking at television, I never saw African Americans, who are a large percent, not a majority by any means, but a large percent of the population. I never saw them on the air unless they were in handcuffs or it was someone famous like Thurgood Marshall or, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Or a ball game.
It's changed dramatically. I mean, you see more African Americans. I don't remember ever seeing an African American on Dr. Kildare, or those programs. It is so. When you look at television now, and you see a far richer view of what America looks like. Now, it's still not where it should be. We've not made as much progress as we should be, as we should have made. But I see, Asian American and Latino and Native American and African American correspondents. I see, all sorts of folks who are reporting and who are doing the work. It's not where it should be, but it's much, much better than it was when I was growing up. When I was on the air, we didn't even have what were sort of derisively called weather girls. I mean, there were no women on the air at all unless they were sort of selling some sort of product. Again, it's changed dramatically. It has changed dramatically. It's not where it should be, but I think things are much better than they were.
Mark Lloyd, our guest today here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Lloyd is the Associate General Counsel and the Chief Diversity Officer at the Federal Communications Commission. Following a distinguished career as a scholar, as a communications lawyer, and as a public interest advocate in Washington, D.C., and as a broadcast journalist for both PBS and NBC. It's an honor to have him here. We've got about 10 or 12 minutes left. If someone wants to call in at 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I've gotten a couple emails here, Mark, from listeners who wanted me to ask you about the experience you have had in the last 4 or 5 months, I don't know, since the late summer, when Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and some conservative radio and television hosts gave you and your appointment to the FCC a considerable amount of attention and regarded it in a fairly negative manner. And this morning, it just coincidentally, I decided to check into some of this. And I listened to a radio broadcast of a radio nationwide radio host named Michael Savage. And I suspect you're familiar with this broadcast. In the broadcast, Mark, he called you a communist vermin, a neo-Nazi, trying to set up a new KGB in a liberal fascist dictatorship. He called you personally a piece of garbage. I was astounded by it, frankly. I mean, I've known you for years, and I think people have heard your voice in this program. They know the tone with which you speak and what you stand for. What was that experience like for you?
Well, some of this I had actually experienced before when we did the report looking at the structural imbalance of political talk radio. It's one of the costs of free speech, and I do believe in free speech, and it's simply one of the prices that we have to pay in a society where we want to allow free expression and we want to give everyone. Even those people, especially those people that we disagree with, an opportunity to say what it is that they have to say. The good thing about it is that I've heard from friends and colleagues and people that I've worked with both in the broadcast industry and as an activist and, as a teacher. I've heard from students and I've heard from folks that I worked with at law firms, and I felt tremendously embraced and supported. So I guess part of the way that I view this is that if there are folks who really are at all interested in what it is that I have to say or think, not that I'm at all important, but that there's plenty of stuff out there to read and to listen to where you can hear the whole thing. You can find out what it is that I'm really saying and not sort of clips or some distortion of it. And make up your own mind about what you think about these things. But again, I remember being called names when I was in the fourth grade and fifth grade. No one likes it, but none of those things sort of reflect me in the way that I think. So.
I think that listeners can draw their own conclusions from listening to you today or going online and watching some of this material at YouTube, but where they can access it all. One thing I would like to clear up, a couple of points that I did see that were commonly talked about on all these attacks to you that got considerable attention. One was a comment by Glenn Beck's on his program that you were fundamentally opposed to any private ownership of media. That struck me as an empirical question, and a yes, no. Is that true?
No. I'm not opposed to that at all. And I've worked as a commercial broadcaster. I think that, you know, our private industry has made very valuable contributions. I've worked with them to make sure that we can have DTV, which is largely private industry. I have very good friends both at in cable and in broadcasting, and work with these guys all the time. So it's almost anyone who's sort of looked at me and seen what I've done know that I'm not at all opposed to that. Now, I very strongly believe that it's extraordinarily important for there to be a vibrant, non-commercial alternative to commercial broadcasting. But not just broadcasting. I mean, I think, you know, it's across media, and I think that would be very useful in this country. I don't think we have it. I think the closest we get is NPR, but I do think that would help. But again, that's a personal view. That's not something that, you know, I'm going to have any say over at the Federal Communications Commission. But I'm a very strong supporter of public broadcasting and public service media.
You know, one other thing, Mark Lloyd, the last on this Beck point, but I watched several of his episodes this morning, or the segments on you, which were numerous. And on several occasions, he made a big deal about how he wanted you to come on air to sort of defend yourself and explain yourself, sort of a man up challenge to get you on there after he had, you know, sort of torn you asunder to his audience. Had he contacted you, or his producers contacted you, to give you an opportunity to go on his program to explain your positions?
No. But I'm also given the fact that that they have taken things completely out of context that I've said, it's hard for me to imagine that would be the sort of format where, you know, I could speak and actually be heard.
You wouldn't necessarily accept, in other words?
Exactly. I mean, I would not consider that to be a productive or fruitful conversation.
I think that's probably an astute assessment of having seen that program enough so far. Hey, Mark Lloyd, let's go back.
God bless him. Let him go on.
Yeah, let's go back to our phone lines. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently to speak with Mark Lloyd. Let's go now to line one, Urbana. You're on the air.
Hello, Mark Lloyd, and welcome to this show. It's nice to be able to ask a couple of quick questions of you. When was the last time the Sherman Antitrust Act was invoked by the FCC, since you brought up antitrust work earlier? And two, do you think there's any connection between the retirement of Bill Moyers the day after he aired the show of Lyndon Johnson's tapes with McGeorge Bundy et al. On the escalation of the war in Vietnam, and subsequently PBS announcing that David Brancaccio's Now has been canceled. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Mark?
Well, on the latter point, I don't know. I would doubt it. I guess my mind just really doesn't go toward the notion of conspiracies. And also, having had some contact with Bill Moyers off and on over the years, I think of him as a man of really impeccable integrity who does not, bend to pressure. And if he faces pressure, he lets his public know that this is what's going on. So I doubt that there is any sort of nefarious reason for Bill to delay, to get off the mm-hmm. air, and for any of these other things to happen. I do think it does speak to the challenges and pressures faced in public broadcasting.
What about antitrust, Mark?
The way that the system works here in the United States is that the Federal Communications Commission, this is not to dodge the question, the Federal Communications Commission looks at whether or not a transfer of a station or some conglomeration issue comes up in terms of the public interest. So does this generally serve the public interest? Questions related to whether this action would be anti-competitive or create a greater market power, while there's some sort of loose view of this under the public interest standard, those questions are largely handled by the antitrust division under the Department of Justice.
On that note, Mark, I want to get to our final caller because we've only got a couple of minutes left. He's been waiting patiently, so let's try to get that call in. Let's go now to line four, our toll-free line. You're on the air with Mark Lloyd.
I do listen to Savage sometimes, several times a week, because I guess I want to be horrified. He was speaking about President Obama going on about his communism and how much it related to, how he would take us into the level that Russia was under Stalinism. And then after he gave this tirade the one night, he came on with an advertisement on training how to shoot. I think it was Texas or something, that there was a place where you can go and learn how to shoot guns in a very, proficient manner. That was just so overt and so scary that I just about ceased to function when I was listening to that. Yeah.
Well, thank you, caller. Mark Lloyd, is anything go basically on air at this point if we're going to respect free speech?
These are very dangerous times. It is shocking the degree to which the president and a few of us have been subject to death threats, even I and the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, as a result of some of these tirades. As someone who works for the federal government, we're limited in terms of the degree to which we can respond to these sorts of things. But, folks are worried about this, and I think the caller raises a very good point.
Well, Mark, I see that we're drawing near the end of our hour. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always great to hear your voice, Bob, and really sort of appreciate the work that you're doing.
Well, thanks very much. And our guest today has been Mark Lloyd, the Chief Diversity Officer at the Federal Communications Commission. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, their engineer. We will be back 1 week from today, 167 hours with another show. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
in the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Today, increasing clouds with a high of 40 degrees. Tonight, cloudy with snow arriving overnight. A light accumulation of less than 1 inch is expected. The low will be about 25 degrees. Tomorrow morning, some snow in the morning, otherwise mostly cloudy with a high of 34. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low of 26. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM.